This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePauw. This week, we feature conversations about our just-concluded Dvorak in America Festival with interviews with special guests, bass baritone Kevin Days and cultural historian Joseph Horowitz. Christina Berger and Orsina Smith give us an insight into the choir and orchestra participation in the festival. Eric Edberg chats with me about the good work the State of the Art class did in preparation. Also on this episode, Hannah Gauthier talks to sophomore Drew Casey about a new student-run pops orchestra. And we catch up with phenomenal pianist Barbara Nisman, the guest artist on our Faculty Select series. There are lots of exciting things going on in the DePauw School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. A few of the interviews you will hear this week would have been aired last week had it not been DePauw's fall break. So we apologize for bringing this to you after the fact, but it was such interesting material, we didn't want you to miss it. As we conclude our Dvorak and America Festival, we move into a flurry of concerts. Thursday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon are all concerts with our guest Kevin Days and our cultural historian Joe Horowitz, but also with DePauw students presenting material for the concert and performing in the concert. And here to chat with me about those concerts are two of our conductors, Dr. Christina Berger with the choirs. Hello.
Hello.
And Professor Orsina Smith of the orchestra. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you both here, and you guys are now going to, in effect, bat cleanup for a two-week festival, and what a flurry we're about to enter into. So the first is on Thursday night, an Indianist concert, and I believe that's mostly choral, is it not?
Well, the chorus is featured on two numbers. Mm-hmm. I think what's mostly about it is that those same two numbers are also going to be heard in other instrumentations. They will be heard as piano solos first, and or as vocal solos with piano accompaniment, and then in choral scoring.
And as I understand it, these are not easy pieces.
No, sir. But thankfully, you know, we've got another whole day to get them ready, so that's okay.
One of them is actually in what? Which tribal language?
Omaha.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it's in eight parts, is that correct?
Well, sort of. Uh-huh. Really many more, because some of those parts are subdivided. So
wow.
It's a walk in the park.
Wow. And of course, the choir has had so much free time on its hands this semester, only performing about 25 times in the first month they were here.
Right, and nothing else to prepare before next weekend, for example. So yeah,
exactly.
We're excited.
So what are these pieces like? Give us a little clue.
Sure. The Old Man's Love Song is, actually, Joe Horowitz likes to describe it as a Hollywood film score. it's very lush and sort of harmonically purple. I mean, it's pretty solidly based in G major, but just about every tone gets chromatically decorated, and so we have, you know, multiple divisions in the voice parts. But threading itself through there is an indigenous melody that the composer collected and then, you know, just harmonized in late romantic sort of parlor style. you know, so if you go at it with some archaeological tools, you can excavate the cantus firmus, as it were.
There you go.
and then the second piece that we're doing is quite different in nature. Again, it's sort of the same approach. Farwell has taken a song from the Omaha Nation and harmonized it, but he hews much more closely to the materials of the original song itself. Just the same sort of small rhythmic fragments and melodic intervals. So we have sort of an 8 and 10 and 11 and 12 part texture. It's almost post-minimalist in a way, the way he uses the materials, but it definitely has a momentum of galloping horses.
So is this the chamber singers and the university chorus?
No, these on the Indianists concert will be only the chamber singers.
So the chamber singers just got to perform with a Native American composer and flautist.
Yes.
With Robert Mirabal and Ethel. And now they're singing music written by white men, emulating Native American music.
Yes.
How do they compare, or do they?
Yeah, they contrast. I mean, it's really a tremendous opportunity for us to have had these two experiences in such proximity to each other. And I think if we look at the ethos behind the production of these two musics, we see the advancement of a certain conversation in academia and cultural criticism, let's say, formally educated elite white America mm-hmm. about what it means to be multicultural right. or to incorporate styles that are not from the Western concert stage, not from the academy, not from white scholarship, white mm-hmm. concert production. So nowadays, you know, to take a piece of material from a non-white culture and mm-hmm. put it into a very, very white style so that it is no longer recognizable, the conversation now is that that would not rightly be called a collaboration. That would be called an appropriation for sure.
Right.
Whereas when we cooperated with Ethel mm-hmm. and Robert Mirabal, there was co-composership. And, you know, Robert doesn't do only indigenous style
right.
music either.
Right.
He's also trained in the Western concert tradition. So both he and Ethel were approaching a conversation in the center of those two traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Both could approach it from each direction. And so that was a true collaboration.
That's fantastic. So, and then Saturday night, our concert is on Dvorak and the Negro Melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And the role that the choirs play in that is
very interesting. Most of the choral music will be sung by the university chorus, but there's one piece that's arranged for tenor, bass, in which we're combining the men of the university chorus and the men of the chamber singers.
Oh, wow. That's mm-hmm. great. And what will those pieces be?
So we're doing two versions of Deep River.
Mm.
First, one that is my sort of transcription and reconfiguration of one that was recorded by the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Mm-hmm.
I kept their same harmonies and just made it work for the voices we have. That was my assignment from Joe, to mm-hmm. start with that. And then after we sing that, we'll have the men singing Burley's arrangement. Now, Burley was assistant to Dvorak.
Mm-hmm.
And the very stunning feature of the Burley arrangement is that there are four bars in the beginning that sound like the opening of the second movement of the Symphony No. 9.
And that Symphony No. 9 is what we're playing on Sunday. So perhaps the most famous work that we will present throughout the entire Dvorak Festival will be the last work we present, which is the Symphony from the New World.
Right. It's a culmination, really. I think people who haven't been around for the last several weeks wouldn't necessarily know some of the history, so I'll start with that. But Jeanette Thurber was in charge of bringing Dvorak to the United States in the late part of the 19th century in order to find an American sound.
Mm-hmm.
Dvorak by that time had become very well known for kind of spearheading nationalism and finding bohemian sounds and integrating that into symphonic works. As well as Bedřich Smetana, who chose to use tone poems. Dvorak chose to do symphonies and make things sound bohemian, which was not something that composers had really done very much. So nationalism was on the rise from the middle part of the 19th century. And Jeanette Thurber said, you know, well, we really don't have an American sound. And she was kind of the executive director of the National Conservatory of Music in New York City. So she brought Dvorak over to a big salary and said, this is your task. And so he set about trying to do that while visiting like-minded people in Spillville, Iowa, who were Czech and Bohemian, and he appreciated being there. He was a little lonely for his homeland and all the comforts of home. He'd come from a lower middle class kind of environment, being a butcher's son. These are things that Joe has all said to us throughout the course of the last several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he embarked on discovery, which when he heard students at the conservatory singing spirituals, he said, I had really not known very much about that. So that seems to be an American sound I hadn't heard before. And then he realized, of course, that there were cowboys and Indians especially, taking up the vast plain. And so he got familiar with that music. And so he then said, project done. I've got the American sound. It's a combination of kind of Native American things and Negro spirituals. And so I'll see you. Bye.
Right. Yeah, spent a very short period of time here, 3 years, and was gone.
So now it gets exciting because Joe Horowitz was very inspired by the background to this. And he did a lot of due diligence and discovered that Dvorak himself was inspired by Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha. So Joe started to find connections between the way in which Dvorak created the motivic elements and the melodic elements of the symphony with storyline from Song of Hiawatha. And so one of the things that the orchestra was tasked to do, as well as myself, was to make sure that we had read the Song of Hiawatha so Joe could reference that when he came to rehearsals. So now cutting to the end of the story, essentially the first part of the concert on Sunday is a set of excerpts that Joe has put by contrast from different pieces that were from that time period in order to set up the New World Symphony and what it came to be known for, which was, as it was reviewed in the early reviews in New York and Boston, that it was this powerful kind of imagery of both Native Americans and spirituals. And so in the course of the symphony as it rolls forward, we have a beautiful kind of lyrical sadness that's expressed at the beginning of the symphony, some kind of powerful music of the plains, some powerful music of conflict. The second movement becomes essentially a spiritual. The third movement is back to kind of a Native American dance. And the last movement is the working out of the conflict, the sadness of the Native Americans being driven from their homes into other places, and the power of the story of the Song of Hiawatha as Dvorak saw it and how it ends. The piece ends very contemplatively, where the last chord is not a powerful stroke, but instead a diminuendo on a long note, as though Hiawatha has disappeared into the purple sunset, and there's a tear in our eye, but we've seen the magic of Dvorak being able to put all these materials together, and the work has changed through Joe's commentary with the students as we've felt Joe's influence about how he talked about the various motivic elements that represent the Native Americans and the Negro spirituals.
And there's actually a visual element of this performance as well, in addition to some narration that's going along.
Right, and Kevin will also sing certain aspects of the spiritual parts from the symphony that eventually turned into spirituals. And the visuals will be presented over the slow second movement, where Going Home is essentially heard, and also then the third movement, which is essentially a scherzo of the Native American dancing. So we'll see works of art painted by American artists from that time placed over the music.
So it's a fascinating series, a troika of great concerts that wrap up our Dvorak and America Festival. Dvorak and the Indianist, Dvorak and the Negro Melody, and then Dvorak and his famous symphony that includes Going Home, the symphony from the New World. A great couple of weeks here at DePauw, and thanks for coming in to chat about it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
One of the exciting things about our Dvorak and America Festival is that our students are taking part in it in several ways. Sometimes they're participants as performers, sometimes they are audience members, sometimes they are masterclass participants, and in the case of Dr. Edberg's State of the Art class, they are presenters. And here to chat with me about that is Dr. Edberg. Welcome back, Eric.
Well, great to be here, Mark.
You guys have a pretty heavy lift through this process.
Well, it's been a really wonderful voyage, and I think the students have gotten a tremendous amount out of working with Joe Horowitz and working on this particular project. One of the big questions that young classical musicians face is, how do we create an event that's truly engaging for an audience, and how do we communicate that to our potential audience?
And in this case, we're trying to give not just great music, but also great information.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is for so many people, when they listen to classical music, especially classical music from the late 19th century, it seems foreign, it seems mm-hmm. remote. Sometimes it seems like it's just formal and boring. And of course, we know that classical music is some of the most exciting and emotionally and spiritually transformative music that's ever been written. Mm-hmm. So what Mr. Horowitz is so great at is what he calls a contextualized concert, a concert where you put the music that's being performed into a historical and intellectual and artistic context. And that's what we're doing with the Dvorak in America Festival.
And it's fascinating because we look at, through 21CM, we've been seeing and witnessing and producing ourselves a variety of ways to present a concert. But the idea of a contextualized concert is relatively unknown. We don't do this very often. And so we as audience members come in and sit down and we hear this great music completely with no contextual bearings whatsoever. And you guys are going to fix that. How are you going to do it?
That's right. Well, for instance, the first concert that the students are hosting is called Dvorak and the Indianist Movement, where we're looking at how in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, white American composers and other intellectuals became fascinated with the plight of the American Indian. Longfellow's poem, The Song of Hiawatha, which became so popular in the late 19th century was something that Dvorak was tremendously taken with, and it inspired him to write a number of compositions, including the second and third movements of what is known as the New World Symphony, Dvorak's most famous symphony, also the Larghetto from his violin sonata. And on one of these concerts, the Indianist concert, this slow movement from the violin sonata actually depicts the character Minnehaha, who was the wife of Hiawatha and who was very moody and who was named for the Minnehaha Falls in Minnesota by her father in the Longfellow poem. And so in this concert, students are performing the Larghetto of the violin sonata, and then Kat Anderson Quinones from the class is leading the audience in a discussion of what they heard. And then she's going to explain the backstory, that this is a depiction of Minnehaha, who ultimately in the poem dies, and the movement ends in a very sad and tragic character. And then they're going to play the movement again, and we're going to discuss, or Kat is leading the audience in a discussion of how this changed their experience. What's the difference when you know what the composer was thinking?
And you know, it's really fascinating because I know that when Joe came in and worked with the students on The New World, one of the first responses from a student after a very long rehearsal and lots of great work being done, saying, you know, I really don't like being told what to think about when I am listening to music. We're leading people to think what Dvorak thought when he wrote that. And what's fascinating to me about this is that we're giving you the choice. Because here, you get to hear it twice. So you're going to hear it once without really knowing the backstory. Then you're going to hear it after you've heard the backstory. And you're going to see, did that really impact how we listen?
Absolutely. And, of course, it's a good question. You know, do you tell the audience what they ought to be thinking or what they ought to be feeling or not? Sometimes I like that. Sometimes I don't.
And I would argue that we do it so much of the time where we don't tell them. It's okay if every now and then we do.
Absolutely. Right. Well, one of the things, especially when we're working to engage new audiences, and there's a real difference between people who are already classical musicians, people who already love the New World Symphony, who've been listening to it for maybe half their lives if they're 20-year-olds right now, and they fell in love with classical music sometime in elementary or middle school, and somebody who's never heard classical music or never heard a particular piece before, it's giving them what the author Eric Booth calls an emotional entry point. And this kind of imagery can make a tremendous difference. And so what we're hoping is that in this particular experiment, we'll find out for the members of the audience who were not already familiar with this piece, and hopefully the liberal arts students who aren't already familiar with classical music, what difference it makes for them.
And I would submit that if an undergraduate in America goes to a concert and hears some really wonderful classical music, wonderfully performed, they'll go on their merry way and they will have enjoyed themselves, but it will not stick with them because it's so foreign. However, coming to the Dvorak Festival, hearing that music in context, understanding that music deeply, that will resonate with them for a far longer time because it was that point of entry for them.
This is certainly our thesis.
Yes.
Now, we're doing another interesting thing. You know, one of the things we've been thinking about is the issue of what's called cultural appropriation, when members of one group take something from the culture of another. And we're looking at that. Antonin Dvorak, when he came in 1892 to the United States, believed that it was the music of African Americans and of Native Americans that should form the basis of an American art music. Now, that when we look back, in some ways is controversial because it's kind of taking music from one culture in one context and importing it to another. At the time, for Dvorak, it was met with great respect and great admiration, and it was met with resistance by some people who really at that time had what we would now very clearly describe as racist attitudes. Dvorak wrote many short pieces, including some humoresques for piano, one of which became perhaps the most popular short piece played by instrumentalists of any stripe, the The great African-American jazz pianist Art Tatum did a cover of one of Dvorak's Humoresques in a kind of reverse cultural appropriation. He took what was you know, one of white culture's most popular short pieces. Fritz Kreisler's recording of it sold millions of mm-hmm. recordings, I think, and did an absolutely extraordinary version, which he played for his entire career. Now, that piece was never notated because jazz at that time in particular was a non-notated tradition, but that piece has been transcribed, mm-hmm. and Jennifer Peacock, one of our great piano majors, is performing that on the concert.
Great.
So we're that puts that piece in a whole different context. And I think... not only musically, but intellectually, these are just really extraordinary events.
I think this is going to be a wonderful set of concerts and a very innovative way to present them. And I appreciate the time in coming in to chat about them.
My pleasure.
We're thrilled to be in the midst of our Dvorak Festival and even more excited about the fact that joining me in the studio are our two guests, the remarkable bass baritone Kevin Days and our cultural historian Joe Horowitz. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
So this morning, you guys were up bright and early, right? So for singers especially. Now, I want you to know Joe was saying something about having to get up early, and I'm thinking he's not singing that early
right.
in the morning.
It's a big difference. I didn't know there was such a thing at 7:30 in the morning, actually.
So the Dvorak Festival has been going on throughout the campus, but today we took it off campus, and you guys were at Greencastle High School. So, Joe, tell me what you were up to.
We did something we've done many times, which is our Harry Burley show. We take about 45 minutes to tell who Harry Burley was, which is to say Dvorak had an African-American assistant whose grandfather was a slave. Mm-hmm. And it was partly from Burley that Dvorak heard spirituals, songs he had never heard in his life, and which he found to be great music. And he subsequently prophesied that the so-called Negro melodies would found a great and noble school of American music. So we unpack that in our Harry Burley show by demonstrating how Burley took these songs that his grandfather would sing and turned them into what we would call art songs, mm-hmm. songs sung by a solo singer with piano, something we take for granted because mm-hmm. it's what Marian Anderson did or Paul Robeson did or Kathleen Battle does or Kevin mm-hmm. Days does. But it had never been done before 1915, and it was first done both as a singer and as a composer by Mr. Burley.
In this presentation, you contextualize it. You give us a little history and exactly what's going on, but then I guess, Kevin, you get to sing some of these tunes.
Yes, sir. My favorite arrangements of spirituals are the Harry Burley spirituals. Mm. They're just written with such wonderful structure and beauty and at the same time simplicity. Mm-hmm. And as Joe and I discuss very often with his arrangements, there's a dignity to the quality of the writing that he uses. So it's always a pleasure to revisit those songs.
Even with Joe as the accompanist?
Joe has such a passion for these pieces. It's actually quite a pleasure. I always tell him when we finish, I can just tell how much he loves these arrangements by the way he plays.
Yeah, we had this great experience last week, Joe, where you sat down at the piano and played an excerpt and then the orchestra played it. And what a wonderful experience that was in immediately bringing an orchestra to an interpretation.
Well, we had a piece that happened to exist in two versions, the American Suite is both a solo piano piece and an orchestral piece. It's like a series of postcards in which Dvorak shares his American impressions, and you hear different things in the two versions. What you cannot hear in the orchestral version is that Dvorak does something kindred to stride piano mm-hmm. when he does his piano version of the third movement. There's no way an orchestra can evoke that, mm-hmm. or the banjo that Dvorak evokes in the piano in the fifth movement. Again, there's nothing in the orchestra that would apprise you. On the other hand, on the piano, you don't have a triangle. So when he evokes the moccasin bells that the Indians have when they dance in the fifth movement, you can only hear that when the orchestra plays it. You can't even suspect it when the piano plays it.
And it's wonderful the way that Dvorak, his life, his work, His remarkable music has all come to life throughout the festival of both weeks. And now we've got some really interesting concerts coming up right around the corner. So, Kevin, what roles are you playing here in these next three concerts that we'll be hearing?
Well, I have multiple roles. One of them is, of course, as singer. And when we do our symphony concert, I'll actually sing a portion of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which we think is evocative of the melody of Going Home. Mm-hmm. And so then I follow that with an actual rendition of Going Home with the orchestra. Mm. And so that's one aspect. And then I have the privilege of essaying several of the Burley arrangements as well prior to that. And so it's a full week, a lot of singing and a lot of talking.
Yes, in addition, you're also a master class last night with our
students. That's right, who were just lovely. It's a wonderful school of music. You can tell by the energy of those students and the faculty what a special place this is.
Yeah, and we are so fortunate to have you here, not only to take part in part of our Dvorak Festival, but also to be a guest teacher here for us and to deliver some master classes for our students and be such a great example for them.
Yeah, they were so responsive and receptive. It was a good experience.
So when we spend our time over the next few days talking about, for example, the Indianist concert, what will we hear at the Indianist concert, Joe?
Dvorak was interested in Indians, first of all, because there weren't any in Bohemia. And secondly, because he took an interest in their culture and their music, having already read the Song of Hiawatha in Czech translation, which maybe has very little to do with Indian culture and music, but it still put him on the same page. And then he spent time with them. We mustn't underestimate his knowledge. In Iowa, virtually every night, with professional Native American entertainers, the Kickapoo Medicine Show. He went to Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show at Madison Square Garden. He had people like Henry Craybill handing him specimens of Native American song. And out of all of this, he attempted to fashion a concert idiom evocative of the Native American that Americans might adapt as iconic for America, which never happened. Mm-hmm. So we're left with this repertoire that's more or less forgotten. Mm-hmm. 30 years of Indianist operas, sonatas, concertos, string quartets, songs. The only piece that really survives is the scherzo of the New World Symphony, which is at its opening an Indian dance, or at least that's what Dvorak had in mind. That's to say that we're going to excavate some music which is never heard. And the composers we're excavating are Cadman and Farwell because they're polar opposites. Cadman wrote a song from the Land of the Sky Blue Waters that was once very, very widely performed, which we no longer hear, and has virtually nothing to do with the sound of Indian music. Farwell, on the other hand, is our Bartok. Mm-hmm. And we should know that and remember him, but we don't, and we don't, because we don't really know much anything about our own musical inheritance.
Right, which is a large part of what the Dvorak Festival is about, that there's a vast difference between American classical music and European classical music performed on American soil.
So this guy Farwell turns out to be a very interesting character who spent time living with Native Americans and transcribing their music, and attempting to do what Bartok did with Transylvanian folk music, which was create a concert idiom that seems to appropriate the vernacular without losing its edge. Mm. It attempts to create an appropriation that remains elemental or raw. Mm-hmm. It's dissonant. It's rhythmically complex. We're hearing an 8-part a cappella chorus sung in Navajo, which is not an attempt to sound like Indian music, but it's an attempt to utilize the music of the Native American in another context. I happen to think it's a masterpiece, but not known.
So our choirs are performing on that concert, and our students are also acting as the master of ceremonies, are they not?
Two of the three concerts incorporate commentary created by students. Mm-hmm. So we have a student who is going to introduce us to Farwell. And of course, the topic is completely new to him, and he's taking it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what he comes up with.
Mm-hmm. And then we go to the Negro Melodies concert, Dvorak on the Negro Melodies, correct?
Yeah. Maybe Kevin would like to talk a little more about Burley. What Burley songs are you singing here for that concert?
I believe I'm doing Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, which my mother forbids me to sing when she's in the room. It makes me too sad. But I'm singing that. Some of my favorites, Every Time I Feel the Spirit, Wade in the Water is another one.
Wow.
And there's a fourth one, but I can't think of what
wow,
it is.
Wow, this is going to be a great concert.
I'm looking forward to it.
As am I. And then the culminating concert is the Sunday afternoon performance with the full orchestra, where we'll get to hear you do Going Home and Swing Low.
That's right, and act as host as well,
yes,
to some degree.
Right.
So I read some quotes from the time, and that's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's terrific.
To do, yes.
I've been fascinated at the far-flung nature of our Dvorak Festival. We've done a presentation at the Janet Prindle Center for Ethics, and just this afternoon we did one on Dvorak and the NFL, an interesting parallel between cultural appropriation for a musician and cultural appropriation for a football team in Washington, D.C. And Joe has been appearing in classes for 2 weeks. Kevin has been giving master classes and working with our students. This has been a remarkable study. People have asked me, how is it that a school that is focused on creating the musician of the 21st century, going back to deal with one from the 19th, but it's become so obvious throughout this festival that Dvorak and his concern for what American classical music could and perhaps should be was a great starting point for us. And it makes us wonder what might have happened had Gershwin lived, had Dvorak stayed, had more people picked up the mantle. And I wonder, Joe, what your thoughts are on the state of American classical music now, given Dvorak's vision was not fully realized.
So what was the vision? The vision, which was not only Dvorak's, it was widespread before World War I, was that we would have a normal musical high culture, which is to say that the Indianapolis Symphony today would mainly perform American repertoire, and so would the Metropolitan Opera, because after all, that's what happened in Russia and France and Germany and Italy. Everybody believed that that would happen in the United States, and lo and behold, it did not.
Right.
So I call our musical culture, our classical music culture, a mutation. It's incongruous. It's anomalous. We wound up celebrating the performer rather than the composer, and the performer, too, was usually foreign-born.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. And you're asking me what happens next. Certainly one thing that has to happen is what's happening here, I believe. I believe that unless this history is understood, there's no way to approach the future, because many things get ignored. It's important to realize that what happened here in the 20th century was strange. And this culture of performance produced performance specialists such that if you were a violinist, that's all you did, or mm-hmm. if you're a pianist, that's all you did, if you're a conductor, if you're a composer, that were unprecedented in the history of Western music. There were no such specialists before 1900. In the world of the piano, there's one guy, maybe, Vladimir de Pachman, before 1900, who doesn't do anything but play the piano. Everybody else composes or conducts. And the reason you need to know that is that it's happening again. Mm-hmm. When we look back on the 20th century, we look back on the 20th century as exceptional, as unusual, mm-hmm. as anomalous. That the performance specialist, not really a normal or organic product of musical training and experience. Why should somebody only perform? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be the future, even though we don't yet fully realize it.
And it's interesting that you mention that, because our guests here on Music for Life bear that out again and again. I'll give you just one quick example. We had Room Full of Teeth here, a Grammy-winning a cappella ensemble, and they have one of their singers, Caroline Shaw, was the youngest winner of the Musical Pulitzer. And she was here, and we were chatting with her, and she said, "Don't refer to me as a composer. I'm not a composer. I'm a musician." And the idea that she's a composer, she's a singer in one group, a violinist in another group, she is widely varied in all of the things that she does, and she does not want to be referred to as a singer or as a violinist or a composer. She wants to be known as a musician.
Right.
And I think that's borne out over and over again, that we're finding that the day of the performing specialist is on the wane, and that we're actually, all things old are new again, because we are marching forward into this brave new world of the 21st century, which is very much like the brave new world of the 19th.
You're right.
Yeah.
Correct.
Thanks for coming in to chat about it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Hello, this is student producer Hannah Gauthier, and joining me in the studio today is sophomore Drew Casey to talk about the DePops Orchestra and their upcoming concert.
Well, happy to be here, Hannah.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no problem.
So can you tell me a little bit about how you got this idea to do a Pops Orchestra?
You know, the other conductor who can't be with us now, David Gordon, we were sitting around and we were just kind of thinking, you know, we're both interested in conducting as careers. And there really isn't any support in undergraduate besides a few conducting classes to really master your, you know, your skills with the baton. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what can we do? Well, we thought about creating a small student group. And if you remember at the recital hour, I had a small string ensemble play something that I wrote.
Yeah.
Dave's been working on something very similar with maybe 8 to 10 musicians, and he's conducting them, or I'm conducting them. And then, you know, we had this kind of revelation, well, you know, let's just make it bigger. And pretty soon we ended up with a full-size symphony orchestra. So it really just snowballed from there. And then we kind of think, well, how are we going to differentiate ourselves? Because, you know, DePaul already has a full-size symphony orchestra. And they play your classic repertoire. But we decided to stick to Pops tunes that can be anything from, you know, movie music, you know, John Williams, to, you know, Disney songs, and video game music, too. I mean, really all forms of media. Pops tunes, what's on the radio right now for orchestra. And that's really kind of what we're trying to embody with this musical endeavor.
All right, that's really cool. How was it getting people to join the orchestra? Was it did you have a hard process recruiting, or did you just combine the two orchestras?
So how it started off is the whole philosophy behind DePops Orchestra is it's open to anybody. We don't hold auditions. It's just if you want to come, you are welcome to play whatever instrument there's a part for. Then I guess the carrot on the stick, if you will be we always have donuts or pizza after for people that attend rehearsals. It's been going quite well. We have a concert coming up. We're going to have t-shirts for that. So if you'd like to buy one.
How much are those going to be?
We're thinking between $5 and $10. We haven't settled on a price yet. That'll be available at the concert. So, yeah.
When is the concert?
November 5th, 7:30 in Kresge Auditorium.
All right, awesome. What kind of stuff are you playing on the program?
I guess another big differentiating factor is that we will be combining other forms of media with the music. We're going to have a movie screen behind us, and we'll be doing the orchestral scores to Star Wars, all 6 of the movies, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Lord of the Rings. And then we're doing a video game music live. So that'll be, that's Dave's piece. He's doing, I think, music from Halo and Civilization.
Oh.
So it's going to be quite the lineup.
That sounds great. Hmm. What's your vision for the DePops Orchestra? What do you see for it?
You know, Dave's a senior, so he'll be graduating, and, you know, that'll be me next year. Where I see for it when I'm here is just a way for students to play this music. And honestly, as much as we say, oh, it's Pops music, it's not as at the same standard of classical repertoire. You know, being the whole 21st century musician, you should be able to encompass all genres of music. And, you know, even if you do end up playing in a symphony orchestra, you know, there's a very, very good chance that you will, you know, play this music at some time for your own Pops concert. And, you know, introducing the musicians to this music early and in a fun, supportive way, and also giving Dave and I the opportunity to conduct a real orchestra, is really unprecedented at an undergraduate level.
Awesome. All right, can you tell us one more time when your concert is?
Yes, the concert is going to be November 5th, 7:30 p.m. in Kresge Auditorium. Admittance is free, so you don't have to be rich to come.
Well, Drew, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me.
It's always a pleasure.
Oh.
We have been thrilled with the visit of Barbara Nisman, a fantastic pianist who has joined us to give a presentation in our recital hour for the School of Music, then an amazing recital that evening, and then a masterclass on the following day. And somehow, in the midst of all of that, she's found time to join us in the studio to chat, and I want to say welcome, Barbara Nisman.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, I came to campus this morning, and the first thing I heard was two students still buzzing about your performance last night. And then I went to a meeting with some faculty, and the first thing that came up was faculty buzzing about the performance last night. In fact, I'll tell a little story here that one of the faculty members said, you know, I was so tired yesterday, and I came in, and I thought, oh, I'm going to maybe make it to intermission, and this is going to be a long program. And he said, the next thing I knew, the thing was over. And I was like, where did that time go? Completely mesmerized the entire time. And his I'm going to do a bad job of quoting him, but it was something like, that's exactly how a piano recital should be presented. So bravo. We all felt that way.
Well, thank you. You know, it was a joy for me, too. It
we
really
can tell you
was.
We're having fun.
Oh,
yeah.
And if I'm not having fun, how can you have fun?
Exactly right. You know, it was really interesting, and I want to take a few moments to chat about that performance. It was a massive program, and I spent the first half on one side of the audience so that I could watch you perform your hands on the keyboard, and the other half so that I could watch your face while you were performing. And you are truly at one with your music. It is so clear that you're having a great time. Is it always that way?
Yeah, it is. And you know what? I'm speaking to the piano and trying to make it do what I think it should do. No, it's, you know, since I was growing up, the piano has always been my best friend. Like my secret friend.
Right, exactly. You know? And it was like watching you have a conversation. I loved actually my seat in the second half more than my seat in the first, although normally I love to watch a pianist's hands. This time, I love to watch your expression. There was a point in the list where it was almost as if you were inviting the next theme in. There was this look of expectation of something's about to happen, and then in came the theme. And then after the theme had come in for about two bars, you smiled as if to say, okay, I like you. I'm glad you're here.
Actually, I feel that way about every note in that list and not.
Yes, I'm sure you do. And in talking with the students and the faculty and the community members who were there, they also commented on the infectious joy of your presentations.
Oh, thank you.
So you really do love to talk to the audience.
You know, it's wonderful to share. And I have to confess that when I go on the stage, it does relax me to talk to you like you're in my own living room and I'm sharing with you music I love. And I have to also say that all the pieces I played last night, I'm passionate about. And I'm not one of these people who could play something I wasn't convinced about.
Right. So. And there was a great quote in the program from a critic that said, when I'm trying to describe Barbara Nisman and differentiate her from other pianists, she's the one that kind of goes jumping off the cliff hand in hand with the composer. I love that. And that was exact total commitment to this music.
Well, you know, there's a little secret part, and don't think I'm a nutcase, but there is a part of me that really believes as if I've known them, or I try to know them. The more you study the layers of their music, you do think you have this intimate friendship with them.
And I love the way that you would tell us what to listen for. Now, here you'll hear him herding the cows and, and asking them to hurry on, you know, and it made it so much more alive for the audience. And the way that our beautiful recital hall is laid out, you can see the faces of the audience even when you're among the audience. So I would glance over every now and then to watch the audience. And I thought, I wish we had cameras filming this, because there's an expression on your face as you're presenting a work and this theme comes in and you're really mesmerized by it and you're kind of having a conversation with it. And that expression on your face is mirrored exactly by the expression on so many faces in the audience who are having this same reaction to it that you're having.
But that's a gift for you to tell me that. That's what. No, that's wonderful.
And I think it has something to do with your commitment to this music, your complete commitment to this music. And you've mastered. This music feels mastered. I'm sure you'll say you've never mastered. I'm still trying.
But you know what it is? It's chipping away at so many layers. And then when you put a piece away, like for instance, the Listen on it, you put it away and then maybe you'll pull it out next year and perform it. It becomes a new piece. And then you said, oh, I didn't think of that. And this is the joy of making music. I think for me, this is the joy of a performer. Oh.
So I'm going to ask you a question here that actually is a confession on my part.
You made a comment, maybe to the students, about people dismissing Liszt as all mm-hmm. sound and fury. I stand convicted because so much of the time I feel that about Liszt. Okay, you've done enough to impress me. Now let's tell me something. And I did not feel that way at all last night. I was so mesmerized by the Liszt, more than I've ever been mesmerized by Liszt. Why was that?
Well, you know, I think it is sometimes the mindset of the performer, because so many of our performers think, oh, he writes all these octaves and all these notes. Let me show you how fast and how loud I can play these octaves. Rather than putting it in the context of his musical message, his musical meaning. And you can even make the Hungarian Rhapsody number 2 not sound like a trite composition. I really think that's that when you approach his music in the sincere way in which it was written, because I do believe that this guy wasn't a show-off. He just had these tremendous gifts, you know, but later in life, it was about this message and what he was trying to convey and what he was trying to share and what he felt was his duty as a musician, as a serious musician.
And it was a profound and powerful performance. And we played the Genist era just before that. Now, we're, as I was saying until yesterday, the Hienist era, but we've been since
I'm relearning that too. Right. Well, you know why? Because he had a Catalonian father, and apparently Pablo Casals mm-hmm. was a very good friend, and Pablo Casals was very proud of his Catalonian heritage. So when I met Ginastera, it was pronounced Hienistera, and right. then he changed the pronunciation in midstream.
Oh, so, is that? Yeah. And we're all going to be catching up, because even last night when I was introducing you, I caught myself still saying Hienistera. It's going to exactly. take a while to get past that and bring it back. But Ginastera wrote his last work for you mm-hmm. and had met you earlier and had heard you perform one of his works. And so I would expect this, and by the way, I'm a big Ginastera fan.
Oh, good.
And loved your performance of that, and I could listen to that all night long. But I would expect that kind of personal connection between you and the Ginastera. But it also existed between you and every other composer you represented. So how do you do that? How is it? I could understand you knew the man. You could represent him. And yet every piece you played, it was as if you knew the man.
Well, it's my great respect for these other composers. Mm. For instance, with Prokofiev, I feel I know Prokofiev. It's like he's in my DNA, the way Liszt is. Mm-hmm. Bartok, I have to confess, even though I wrote a book on Bartok, less so, because I find Bartok less like Liszt, more like Beethoven, where you have to keep peeling the onion. Bartok mm-hmm. is not as accessible for mm-hmm. me, even pianistically. Mm-hmm. He doesn't make it easy for you. But that's the challenge. And in a way, I'm going to use another word, I think it is the responsibility of every performer. Mm-hmm. I'm only the middleman. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I guess I am a teacher. That's what performers are supposed to be. I was trying to share with you how much I love this music and in a way try and explain in those few seconds I had to introduce the pieces what you were to listen to. You know, in a way, be your seeing eye dog there.
Right. Yeah, and you did such a great job of setting those up for us and with such passion and conviction. And then you sat down to play a series of incredibly difficult works, and yet all of them seemed simple.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's great.
Nothing seems
hard. You see,
hard.
practice. Yeah.
So I have a relationship with Kenny Werner, a great jazz pianist, and he wrote this book called Effortless Mastery. Uh-huh. My favorite title of any book of all time, Effortless Mastery. And I thought Kenny would love this because
it has to be effortless.
That is effortless mastery. What we saw last night on stage was effortless.
You know what? We were talking about the joy. And actually, this reminded me of, I was recently in Mexico and a young man came backstage and then sent me an email and he said, how do you play so effortlessly and how do you convey the joy? Is there a book I can read? And I did answer the email, but I had a difficult time trying mm-hmm. to explain. Of course, the first thing is to play without tension, because if you're playing with tension, nothing can come out. It's like a hose where it just doesn't squirt the, you know,
right.
the full pressure of the water. So that's a given. And then the joy of the music is already there. With our job is really to get out of the way.
Right.
So that this wonderful music can come from the composer mm-hmm. and reach you. And I don't interfere. I mean, sometimes the piano interferes or, you know, or somebody's cell phone interferes. But no, the whole idea is that direct communication. We are only the conduit for that.
Right. This music is passing through us.
Yeah. And isn't that a
and
privilege?
I was just going to say the very same thing. And we're very fortunate to have that happen.
And, you know, I still believe that this does come from a higher source, especially when the magic truly
happens.
Right,
when the magic happens.
So in, it's not us.
My career as a conductor, people will see me conducting and say, boy, you must be a great dancer. I'm a terrible dancer. I couldn't dance to save my life. But the music
podium,
is moving
exactly.
you in this certain way. And I felt that way about you. I thought as I was watching her play about, she's a great dancer, you know, because it's
not true.
Because you were so moved by the music and you're so touched by it.
But you know, and this is all, it's all unconscious. That's mm-hmm. why I'm saying we do get help. Sometimes mm-hmm. I even think, actually last night I did feel Liszt spirit and I felt Chopin spirit. Yeah. With my encore, I was thinking, my goodness, where did that come from?
And what a great encore to play against type. You know, for the whole concert,
I was rewarding you for that difficult program.
We loved that program. Everybody was completely mesmerized by it. And I think it was the effortless mastery that everyone so clearly understood. It didn't matter what you knew about piano or music or Liszt. You realized that this was happening.
Well, you know, the message is universal because I really do believe it is about love and joy. It is about something much higher than we are. It's, you know, in every single piece of music we play, that's the way the ideal should be.
And so now you're leaving us from the interview to go do a masterclass, and I'm wondering, how do you convey that joy and conviction and mastery? What is it that you're hoping to do when you take someone who is you as an undergraduate trying to find their way?
Well, you know, everybody comes to master classes with a different level of talent. And I think the whole idea is to at least raise them a little bit, you know, make them a little more aware of how to listen. And most of, you know, they prepare a piece, they usually don't listen. So I'm adding my ears to theirs and hopefully giving them some ideas. You know, there's a wonderful quotation. I remember my husband quoting it because he was a poet, and it's from T.S. Eliot. And it's really brilliant because he said, good poets imitate, but great poets steal. So that's what we as performers are constantly doing with each other. That's why we listen to recordings of the old masters.
Right. I feel that way as a composer too. You know, let's steal it. And if no one recognizes it, it's even better. Then we'll save some money in royalty fees. You know, there's always that. It's interesting because I think you've set our students up in a way in your performances of the past 2 days to really see their music and their performance of their music in a different way. Because, you know, when you're spending all those hours slaving away in the practice room, you're thinking, what am I getting from this? But it's there. It's a little further down the road than we might want it to be, but it is there. And when you're in the presence of that type of performance, you know it, and it's rare.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know, that once the foundation is set, and then we have fun. You know, like most of these kids will come prepared, very well prepared. So they've done all the hard work. Now we can have the fun of you know, making music and shaping it and having another viewpoint.
And that's what we saw last night, was the fun of it. Everyone had such a great time.
Oh, thank
you. You were so dedicated to this music and so clearly in control. And we loved every minute of that performance and of your time on campus. We hope you'll come back and visit us
again
soon.
Well, you know, it's been a joy to be here. It's a wonderful university. And for me, it's my first visit.
And not your last.
Well, that's good. I look forward to my next one. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in to chat with us.
My pleasure.
Concluding this episode from her performance on Wednesday, September 24th, 2014, as a Faculty Select Series guest artist, pianist Barbara Nisman plays the final movement, Vivace, from the 6th Piano Sonata, Opus 82, of Sergei Prokofiev. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Music for Life. We love hearing from listeners. You can contact us by emailing musicforlife@depauw.edu. We're also on Facebook at DePauw Music for Life, and you can subscribe to our show on iTunes by searching there for DePauw Music for Life. Our student producers are Anna Gadula, Matt Skiba, Burke Stanton, Rachel Amalfitano, Hannah Gauthier, and Caleb Denning. Our 21CM graduate intern is Elika Okerstrom. Veronica Pedrell is our online editor, and our show is produced by Matthew Champagne in the Judson and Joyce Green Center for the Performing Arts at DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. I'm Mark McCoy, Dean of the School of Music. Thank you for listening to our show. Keep music in your life, and have a great week.
It's Music for Life.